You're listening to Builderpedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Builderpedia. Joining us today is Philip Knorr from PCN Urban. So Philip is a certified practicing planner, registered architect, and has a lot of experience in local government. Philip, welcome. Tell us about your new venture, PCN Urban.
Thank you very much. PCN Urban is my new umbrella business for my business structure, which has been, actually it's been probably going for about 10 years in the background when I've needed it, but it's been resurrected well and truly. That's been going for about 3 months and I'm very busy.
Okay. Well, we better get to asking some good questions because, yeah, I know what it's like. So you've been at Weir Phillips, which is a very well-respected, well-regarded heritage architects and heritage practice.
Yeah.
And so you've got miles of experience and you've got council experience as well. You've worked with council.
Well, look, I started off life studying architecture, which is a long commitment. You know, there's 6 years of that. A lot of people don't make it all the way through. That was great fun. I worked as an architect for about 5 to 10 years. And that the last 5 years of that 10 years, I started drifting into the town planning space just organically. And I thought, gosh, there's this thing called town planning, which I didn't really know about before. And it's quite interesting. You know, that's the town planning is the big picture. So it's interior design is architecture on a small scale. Architecture is the whole building. Town planning is architecture on a big scale. And it's also the managing, you know, the evolution of cities and urban spaces and so on. So I thought that was very interesting. And then I morphed into heritage as well. So I wear a lot of caps, but these days I don't really do traditional architecture. I mostly tell other architects what to do, but I give them advice.
It's funny because you say town planning is the big picture, but a lot of my experience with town planning is very small details about specific roof lines and the pain of architecture. So how are those two kind of reconciled?
That's how we experience it that's how most architects experience it in everyday life, is the minutiae of rules and regulations. And we call that statutory planning. That's, you know, working your way through the town planning regulations. So real town planning, the big picture stuff, we call that strategic planning, and that's designing the rules and the controls and essentially designing the cities, how the cities are going to look, how they're going to work, how they are.
So which one do you do day-to-day, the minutia and the applying of the rules or the big picture?
I do the minutia. I help people navigate through the extremely complex set of rules that we have in town planning in New South Wales.
And you overlay that with heritage, so do you do heritage reports as well?
Exactly, and I overlay that with heritage advice. So I don't think it's officially recognised, but some people have coined the term heritage planner. So I think you could possibly describe me as a heritage planner.
So, Philip, I have to ask you, are you part of the heritage mafia?
Would anyone admit to that?
We should explain the heritage mafia is otherwise known as the group of respected heritage consultants who occasionally meet to discuss heritage.
Okay, well, I thought you might be talking about the heritage purists who give everyone a hard time and, you know, hold developers to ransom over small details of heritage significance.
No, I'm talking about the clique of heritage, the respected heritage consultants who kind of all know each other, respect each other. I've been told have cocktails occasionally. I don't know if this is true.
I can't really reveal this because this is what you call secret heritage people business. But look, there's not very many of us in the scheme of things. It is a very small profession in New South Wales, so we generally all know each other, and I'd like to think that I'm part of that grouping.
Yeah, and I guess the thing about that I find hard to explain to clients, because I guess as builders and architects, we engage planners and heritage consultants, and we need to explain to clients that there's this construct called heritage consultants that isn't really, there's no qualification as such. There's no license to be in effect, I could be a heritage consultant tomorrow.
That's right. We don't need to be registered. Well, look, actually, that's not quite true. I think there's a system of registration with the Heritage Council, which most people don't talk about very much. I think a lot of people don't realise it's there. But in day-to-day practice, you're a heritage consultant if you say you are and if you can say you are persuasively. So either you've been working in the field for a long time, and of course, look, there are some very well-regarded heritage consultants in Sydney who just have a degree in architecture and no other heritage qualifications, but they've been working in the heritage space for years and years and years. So, you know, the experience trumps everything. Then, of course, there's the other ones who actually have a qualification in heritage. And they may or may not be architects. Some of them have degrees in town planning or geography or something completely different, but they've got a degree in heritage, which is usually a master's or graduate diploma of heritage conservation from Sydney Uni, which is the main heritage school in Sydney.
Yeah. So obviously you're not going to tell us about, you know, all the secret rituals and secret things that heritage
such
people
as the
do.
Secret handshake.
Secret handshake.
Well, that's secret, so I can't tell you about it.
Of course. So moving on, I guess, because we're dwelling on heritage a little bit, but we both work in that realm. So certainly it's always an interesting space because it really is something, as a registered architect, you have to study and practice and pass tests and then you can be a registered architect, and it's this mountain you've got to climb. And if you call yourself an architect and you're not one, they go after you hard.
You get into trouble.
Yeah, you're in big trouble. It's against the law.
Not quite as much trouble as you do if you call yourself a heart surgeon and start doing heart surgery. But
yes, but you will get sued by the
You will get into trouble.
Yeah, you will be in trouble, and they'll tell you very quickly that you should not do that. They have their spies. But as a heritage consultant, I can just say I'm a heritage consultant, put it on my website, and no one will. Well, people will know.
They might want to know what your qualifications
Maybe.
Are. And at the end of the day, it's going to rest on your reputation. If you're any good, then people will keep using you. If your advice is no good, then people aren't going to come back for very.
Okay, we've covered heritage. What about town planning? So to be a planning consultant, and I guess to give listeners context, if we're, as registered architects, when we're putting a DA together, when we're getting approval for a project, we would get a planning consultant when things are tricky or when things are difficult, when we need some support or when things are marginal and we rely on an opinion. So what's the qualification for a planning consultant?
Well, generally speaking, once again, a lot of people can call themselves planners. There's no title that is protected by law. But if you're looking for a planner, the key things you want to look out for are whether someone's got qualifications, so they've got a degree in planning, whether undergraduate or postgraduate, but particularly, are they a member of the Planning Institute of Australia? So that's one box to tick. The next box to tick is whether or not they have some sort of accreditation with the Planning Institute of Australia. And the Planning Institute of Australia, probably 10, maybe 15 years ago, actually possibly 20 years ago now, had a scheme called Certified Practicing Planner, which I was registered with. They're superseding that or with this thing called a registered planner, which is a very similar thing. But you really want to know that your planning consultant is qualified, that ideally they're a member of the Planning Institute. And it's very helpful if they've got some experience behind them to back them up. One of the things that is most useful, in my view anyway, for a consultant planner is that they've got experience in either local or state government. It depends what you're hiring them for. If you're hiring them primarily to deal with local government on your behalf, it's great if they've got experience with that particular council that you're dealing with, or that they've got council experience generally.
We sort of say it's okay if it's an analogous council. So if it's for example, I would say in terms of planning, parts of Woollahra are analogous with Balmain because they're very similar.
Yeah, they're similar urban environments. The planning is sort of similarly contested and controversial, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the case. New South Wales has the same planning system across the state. Theoretically, every council operates under the sort of same structural umbrella. So I think if someone's got experience with Woollahra Council, they're just as capable of helping you with a development application in Broken Hill.
Yeah, absolutely. But the reverse may not be true.
The reverse might not be true because Woollahra, Inner West, North Sydney.
Yeah.
These councils have very particular issues.
Yes, and just the geography is very particular and the scale is very particular.
Oh, it's a much, as I said before, it's a much more contested space. People are much more likely to object. Well, some neighbours are more likely to lodge objections to a development application, and they're likely to spend a lot of money doing that. And they're likely to hire their own planning consultants, and they're likely to hire planning lawyers to do that. So it all gets a little bit more exciting and juicy, and it's a bit more rough and tumble.
Yeah, and so getting into the rough and tumble, I guess your superpower is your planner and a heritage consultant kind of in the one?
I think my superpower is really that I started life off as an architect.
Yeah, so you bring all three things together because normally they're like on that...
They're separate.
Yeah. Normally when you have that conciliation meeting with council, you've got the architect, the heritage consultant, then the planner. So you could save me a lot of money, I guess, because I'm not paying for free lots of fees. Or maybe you're more expensive.
That's a very pertinent point. If we're going to go to the bottom line, yes, look, I do a lot of court cases where I am engaged as both the planning and heritage expert. So my clients have to hire one expert instead of two.
And I've been in so many of those meetings where there's two or three and there's a room full of, and you're looking around like, yeah, it is the bottom line. Like it is a kind of wicked economic
and it's too many
version
ships.
Of it.
It's too many ships.
Yeah. And you kind of look around and you go, collectively, there's like, I don't know, $3,000, $4,000 an hour being spent. Can everybody just talk a little bit faster, please?
Or talk a little bit less coherently together. But yeah. Going back a step, in terms of what you call my secret power, I think my secret power is, in terms of value adding, that I did start off life as an architect and that I can see design solutions to planning and or heritage issues, which no one had hitherto identified. Now, I used to work as an architect. I am an architect. I don't like to tell other architects what to do or how to design their buildings. So there's a fine line there because I know that architects can be a little bit precious about being told how to do their design, but I'm quite happy to, and it's very useful for me to provide my input of alternative options. And quite often these might be things nobody's thought of before. They might not have thought, because it's always helpful to have a second pair of eyes. So I might look at something and say, well, why don't you try this? And they'll look at it and say, well, we hadn't thought of that. Similarly, it works both ways. Sometimes people say to me, we could try this. And my response will be, gosh, I wish I'd thought of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you've hit upon is what I've discovered is the secret to getting things done with planners, particularly when I'm putting a DA team together or putting a DA in, or my team is putting a DA in, I should say, then the best thing I can do to help that process is to sit with the other planner, or particularly if they're a council planner, and empathize and understand from their perspective. And I think we've been a lot more successful since we've, well, for a start, been very positive, and secondly, understood from their perspective that they've got a desk full of, like, not literally like a physical desk maybe, but a desk full of
not anymore, but
yeah, we used to. But in effect, lots of things on their desk to deal with not enough resources, not enough headspace.
Yes.
And so we've taken the approach, we know you want to get this off your desk and we want to get it off our desk effectively. How can we work this out has helped a lot, I think. That's my hypothesis, but also my experience. How do we collaborate to get this worked out? Because it feels like there's this preemptive oppositional stance that everyone walks into a application with, where it's, okay, we know this is going to be a problem. And I always like to ask the question, well, before we know it's a problem, do we actually have a problem?
Yeah, well, look, I might just enter there. I have a theory about council planners and their attitude towards development, and it's slightly facetious and it might not be universally true, but my feeling is that the default position is that all development is bad, as in all buildings are bad, and the best development is no development at all. But if it has to be done, absolutely has to be done, then the smaller it is, the better.
What's the root cause of that, or where do you think that comes from and why?
I think it comes from the fact that our planning system, when it was designed as a reactionary system. So you have to go back a little bit to the history of town planning as it developed as a profession, why it developed and how it evolved. And, of course, it evolved in response to the inner city slums, noxious industries in inner city areas, which impacted everyone's amenity. And, you know, we had public health issues and sanitation issues. And I mean, it's all connected with town planning. So what you find still in today's planning system is that you have zoning controls, which tell you that you can't have factories or abattoirs or smelters in residential areas. Fair enough, because they affect people. We have this concept of amenity. They affect people's amenity. So then when you get to planning controls for purely residential areas, we adopt the same approach. We're concerned about affecting people's amenity in terms of, is the development going to overshadow them? Is it going to create noise or privacy impacts or overlooking impacts? Is it going to block their views? So what negative effects is this proposal going to have? So we look for all the negatives. What we're not that good at looking for is, what are the positives? So we have to check all these boxes about the negatives, but not necessarily, we don't focus so much on the positives. Maybe we do a little bit now, but there has historically tended to be this focus on preventing the worst, but not necessarily encouraging the best.
Yeah, and so how do we get out of that loop? Okay, three pieces of information. One is that actually most mayors, well, I won't say, I can't say most mayors. Most mayors that I've spoken to, which is one, which is Darcy Byrne, the mayor of Inner West, who is the mayor that represents my neighbourhood. He doesn't want to be the mayor of the dysfunctional planning department, and I think he's genuine in wanting to improve things. So that's the first bit of information. Like they want to be proactive. The second thing is that objectively, they're destroying value in the process. They're destroying money. They're burning money through fees and other things that are unnecessary sometimes. But also, thirdly, they're not focused on adding value to the community. So between those things, like there's a bit of a will and a case to go, well, it really needs a little bit of a reboot. You know, in the past, I've sort of brainstormed about what can change, but what if you're the czar of planning in the state of New South Wales or pick a council that you run both, right? What do you do? What do you change?
Very open-ended question. I probably don't have the answer, but there are some ideas which could contribute to a better situation. Probably a good 10 years ago, tentative efforts made to rewrite the Planning Act. It didn't get very far. They sort of pulled the plug on that and decided to simply renumber the clauses. So I think it's a decimally structured planning act now.
Okay. Well, that's a good start. Well,
maybe that helps a little bit. And I think only now we're just getting used to the new clause numbers. So, yeah, clause 4.55 instead of clause section 96, et cetera, et cetera. That helps. But a lot of positive things have been happening in the planning system in the last 15 to 20 years. And incrementally, it's all been going in the one direction. And a lot of those things are positive. Some of the things that have been happening, I think, have been going in the wrong direction. But starting with rewriting the Planning Act, I think that probably has to happen to make it more proactive and less reactive. But something that our Planning Act and our planning system does particularly, and has for a long time, you know, ever since the County of Cumberland plan in the 1950s, we have this concept of zoning. And that's all about making sure that people aren't living next door to factories and other noxious land uses. But something that happens in other places, particularly in the United States, is they have this concept of form-based controls, form-based plans, where there are some communities which almost don't regulate land use at all. Whereas for us, the first step is to look at the land use. Is the land use permissible in that zone? That's the first thing we do. As a matter of process, we look at the land use. But under some planning controls in the United States, they have form-based controls. And when I say form, I mean the physical form, three-dimensional form.
The shape and size.
The shape of the buildings. So you can have any use that you like on that lot, on that land, provided that it fits within that three-dimensional form. And in fact, ideally, it's not smaller or larger than that three-dimensional form, because the controls are built around achieving a certain urban design and architecture or urban design outcome. It's that broad brush. So if it's smaller, then you know, you've got a tooth gap. It doesn't quite work. If it's bigger, it doesn't quite work as well. But if it's generally consistent with that three-dimensional form, then you're starting to achieve a cityscape, townscape, that has a particular vision. Now, that's attractive to me because I come from a design-based background. So I'm always, you know, my natural inclination is to think about the aesthetics first, and that appeals to me very much in that sense.
Yeah, and the only time I've ever had that discussion and proposed where we had a street full of two-story buildings, and I proposed that we take the only building that was out of like sink and one story, not only one story, but one story pyramidal roof that looked like it crashed into the building next door and got latched on and got stuck, proposed to turn it into a two-bedroom. And of course, it was pushed back by Heritage on the grounds of we want to maintain the diversity in the street.
Well, yes. I suppose, look, the argument there from their point of view was that the urban character, because it's not a new subdivision, it's not a new urban development, the existing character is one of diversity.
In that case, it was on an adjacent street. They argued the opposite, where they argued for consistency. The commonality was, please don't change anything in either of these streets. So
it's horses for courses. If you look at some parts of Newtown, there's a degree of diversity, and having too much consistency would be a little bit at odds with that. If you're looking at a row of terrace houses, townhouses in Edinburgh, designed by Robert Adam in the late 1700s, then it's, you know, or in Bath, they've got to be consistent because it's part of a grand architectural design composition.
Absolutely.
So different set of circumstances.
Different horses for courses. And we were going to talk about the misconceptions about heritage listed properties, or we could stretch a little bit to include heritage conservation areas, because of course some buildings aren't heritage listed but are in a heritage conservation area. So what is the downside? What are the misconceptions?
There are a lot of misconceptions. I think the main misconception is that if you have some sort of heritage listing, then you can't do anything. So, and that ranges from being in a conservation area or being a heritage item. The concern and often the automatic assumption is that your site is frozen in time and you can't do anything. That's only true to a point. And sometimes it's not true at all. And sometimes there are considerable advantages. So to dig deeper into that, I think you need to understand the difference between a heritage conservation and area and a heritage item and the other forms of heritage listing in New South Wales, which differs from other jurisdictions as well. And every part of the world has its own way of doing these things. But in New South Wales, we have the sort of the lowest level, the lowest grade, and not saying lowest to diminish from it. We have the lowest grade of heritage listing, which is a heritage conservation area, which is sort of like it's a listing for a whole urban area. So it's a listing for a collection of buildings, landscapes, roads, urban spaces. And what's important in that conservation area is the collectivity. So the collection of objects in that landscape, in that context, and how they're perceived externally, which might just be from the street, or it might be maybe from neighbouring backyards or rear laneways. But although there are some differing opinions on this, but arguably what's inside the buildings doesn't matter. Now, some councils would like to maintain that at least if the front lobby is visible from the street, then that matters. That contributes to the conservation area. Council controls will often say that the front two rooms matter. But if you go to the exempt and complying codes, they will permit you to completely gut the interior of a building in a heritage conservation area.
Yeah, and that's the conundrum of planning, where if you were only doing the interior, you can really do almost whatever you want as exempt. You can refurbish the rooms, remove fireplaces as you see fit.
Exactly.
But the minute you put a DA in, they want to tell you what you can do.
Will. And you can say to them, look, under a CDC, I could remove all of the marble Victorian fireplaces in this Paddington Terrace and you won't get a look in. And they will typically say to you, well, that's fine. You put a CDC in, but we won't let you do it under a DA. I'm not recommending for a moment that you remove original marble Victorian fireplaces, because I think they're important. But the reality is that if you want to do it, you can. There is a mechanism for doing that. Anyway, so I suppose that answers the question as to what the constraints are in a heritage conception area. Well, partially answers it. So internally, there is a way in which you can do whatever you like. Generally speaking, in most conservation areas, you can demolish probably the accretions at the back of your building.
Tell us what accretions are, because that's a bit...
Yeah, the unsympathetic alts and ads that were done in the 60s and 70s.
The lean-tos and the bits.
The lean-tos. Yeah. And often quite old lean-tos that aren't visible from the street, don't contribute to the heritage value of the building or contribute to the character of the conservation area because nobody can see them. So quite often what most councils expect you to do is maintain the form of what they call the principal building,
yep,
which is what's under the main roof. And then you can add often quite contemporary structures to the rear, as long as they're subordinate, recessive, and don't have a significant impact upon the streetscape or the character of the area.
Yeah. So I'll road test my kind of generic advice or universal advice around heritage conservation areas, and particularly, I guess, inner west, parts of the east certainly applies. It's very much the rule of thumb. You've got all these different complicated ways of seeing things and talking about things, but the long and the short is if you're impacting or changing the streetscape, that's going to be pushed back. As a rule of thumb, if you're altering the streetscape, you're going to get a bit of pushback. So what we need to do is, doesn't matter what we're doing, don't worry about details or specific, like how many rooms or how many. Of course, there's other planning regulations like FSR, floor space ratio, that come into it. But putting those, assuming you're compliant with those, we can pretty much do what we need to do. We'll just kind of have to hide it or mask it or not impact the street. Like that's the long and the short of, you can almost distill 90% of heritage conservation areas to say, just don't change the streetscape and it'll be all right. How fair is that?
Yeah, that's the rule of thumb. Where it gets contentious is that little gray zone in the middle where maybe you can see a little bit of it. So how much visibility is too much? How much of this new object to the rear of the original building in the streetscape is it appropriate to see? And then also the discussion can revolve around, well, what should you retain of what's at the rear? So, for example, in the city of Sydney, you have a lot of inner city areas, you have rear laneways. Now, but that's almost considered a secondary frontage as well. And people will want to, the council will want you to retain the character of that rear lane presentation to a lesser or greater extent. So that becomes a subject for...
Yeah, particularly when you have an intact row of, and it's a, there's a rhythm to it.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, often terraced houses have what they call these fingers, you know, the service things projecting to the rear. Probably over the past 20 years, we've become increasingly protective of those fingers. And we've got to keep the fingers.
Particularly when there's a few fingers in a row and they sort of look like they're part of the same hand.
There's a row of half a dozen fingers and they want to keep the fingers. I suppose that's fair enough. It's part of the composition.
Yeah. So moving away from heritage a little bit, I have this hypothesis that I've been working on and I wanted to share it with you. I kind of think that council gets, certainly the legislation and the planning departments in council have a lot to answer for. I just feel like they get all of the blame for all of the problems in between the legislation and the government and the local council. They get all of the blame. And I kind of have this hypothesis that some of the blame is actually the system around the I'm blaming you essentially, Philip. I think that there's that industry of consultants around planning, lawyers, consultants, heritage consultants, planning consultants have a part to play and need to put their hand up and share some of the blame. So it might be controversial, but I thought I'd see what you think.
I think it has been said that with a very complex, contentious planning system, you have the creation of a lot of opportunities for consultants to make a living. I won't say make a lot of money, but some of them do. And some planning lawyers make a lot of money out of the fact that we've got a difficult, complex planning system and often end up in dispute. Now, I don't think for a moment that anyone has deliberately designed a complex, difficult to navigate planning system so that they or their colleagues could obtain a source of revenue out of it. But that's just what happens. That's a result of the system. And because of the complex system, you need people with particular specialized skills to navigate it, and they will charge for their services accordingly. And they might not complain about the fact that they have a source of work. Now, the fact that people are often in planning disputes with council, they take these disputes to the Land and Environment Court, they hire me as an expert witness, and I charge for that accordingly. But I do have a sense of ethics, and if something can be resolved without doing that, no one would be happier than I.
Yes, so everyone... It's kind of that conundrum where even if everyone acts ethically and thinks ethically, there's this kind of skewed economics where there's in effect an incentive, whether it's conscious or unconscious, to have more disputes and more problem DAs. And the thing that kind of I think exacerbates that is that there are consultants on both sides representing both sides, and sometimes those someone has said to me, and I don't know that it's as much of an issue, but there are firms that represent both council and represent private clients, not in the same case, obviously, but does that help create an industry around planning?
I don't think so. In fact, I actually think it's healthy. I think it's because, well, if you're in the context of a court, land and environment court case, for example, the chief duty of an expert is to assist the court. This is under the expert witness code of conduct. Their responsibility is to assist the court, not to assist one party or the other, which would mean the party who's paying them. Now, that your natural inclination, if you're being paid by someone, the assumption is that your job is to assist them. But if you're an expert witness in the Land and Environment Court, your job is to assist the court and to assist in the resolution of the dispute, to engage in the spirit of the process. Now, I see that very often. I see people engaging in the process who don't have that highest in their mind, but that's how it's meant to work. And I think it's very healthy for consultants to work on both sides of this supposed fence, because it means that they can see the big picture, and they can be more objective in tackling the problem.
Okay, so back to my question: is there putting that? Do they carry some of the blame for the inefficiencies and the problems, or
no? No? Well, I think the problems with the system are multifaceted, and I don't think that's really the problem with the system. And I don't know if you want to bear with me while I tell you what I think the problems with the system are, because a lot of people you engage with will probably share their opinions about it as well. But I think the Planning Act is part of the problem, but not especially in and of itself. I think, to be more general, I think the part of the problem is that we're overregulated in New South Wales. Now, you talk to people who practice architecture and in development in somewhere like Victoria, they have much less regulation. They're in for a rude shock when they come to work in New South Wales. So I think we overregulate. We regulate things that we don't need to regulate, or we regulate things which are not really, shouldn't be the domain of local government or shouldn't be the domain of building regulation. For example, a lot of council controls have dictates in them about having recycling bins of a certain size under the kitchen bench, and very, very detailed things about waste management in your kitchen. And if you go through a council DCP, you will find stuff like this. Not all councils, but some of them. Now, all of these things are good ideas. It's a great idea to have recycling, separation, rubbish separation underneath your kitchen countertop, but they shouldn't be in our planning controls. Certainly they can be in handy hints documents or design guidelines or something like that, but they shouldn't have the status of legislation, particularly because nobody checks.
So what's a way to fix that? We at state government level too. I mean, I guess complying development, otherwise known as CDC, fixes a lot of that because it makes it go away. But what else? What's the thing like the current Minns government can do that they're not thinking about that you just haven't been? Maybe you've wrote in a letter to Chris Minns, but he hasn't read it yet. What is that? What are those leverage points that they can?
I think we need to significantly simplify our planning controls.
Yeah.
No, look, LEPs are okay. They're fairly cut and dried and straightforward. But I think we need to simplify our DCPs. Now, I understand.
So DCPs, are, just to clarify, are which level of government?
These are administered by local government. They're the development control plans. They sit in that sort of layer underneath local environmental plans. So local environmental plans are a legislation, effectively. They're on the government legislation website. They have the status of law. Development control plans have the status of guidelines, but they're applied as if they do have the status of law and they are a consideration under the Planning Act. But they also have layers of controls that are dealt with by other mechanisms, such as environmental sustainability controls or energy efficiency controls or controls about window which direction your windows face and how much sunlight they get, which are all controlled by BASICs.
Okay, you're not going to control councils, right? Because they've got an agenda, they've got a diverse group of people, and they've got vested interests, and there's deals being done to gain support. And if the mayor, I'm not saying about anything about our mayor in the West or any other mayor, but potentially there's a vote, and a particular councillor says, "I'll vote for you, but I want you to put bins under the counters in the DCP," you're not going to control that. So what do you do at state level to curtail that?
Well, I think what you're talking about tends to happen more with things like rezoning and increasing the height or FSR limits, things like that. Bins under the countertop, I attribute really to someone in council, so a manager in council, saying to the junior sustainability officer, okay, here's your job for the next 3 months. Write me a chapter for the DCP on sustainability. And you know, they want to impress, they want to get their incremental pay rise at the end of the year, their next salary review. So they put in as much as they can think of.
Yeah. But you're never going to stop the junior, or you're never going to stop that, are you? There's always a wild card in there. But how do you stop it at a different level?
I've worked in council. I've seen all of this. This is, people want to do a good job. They want to get a promotion. They want to get a pay rise. They want to say, look at this big document that I prepared. It's this thick and it's got all these good ideas in it. So, look, it's people with the best intentions in the world doing the best that they can, but not necessarily seeing the big picture. And that's the problem.
Yeah, but what you're saying is, in effect, that could, anything could appear in there, and suddenly it's a guideline that's sort of enforced as a law, and there's no is that a core sort of crux problem that we need to solve to go?
Look, it's one of the problems. It's not the core problem, but I think the Department of Planning has for a little while had a program. I don't know where it's at, but they're talking about having a standard template DCP so that there is a DCP format statewide which would have a particular wording, particular format, and address particular issues and still retain local identity. I think that's an excellent idea, because a lot of DCPs really need to be culled, because they're repetitive, they're confusing, they don't really do what they intend to do. And they address a whole lot of things which either they shouldn't be addressing or are never policed anyway. And just going back to that recycling separation under the countertop point, nobody checks that. That the council development assessment officers don't go through a checklist checking whether it, you know, the bins are appropriately supplied in individual kitchens.
Fair enough.
So I think that's another thing that we could do to...
Okay, so that's a great idea, I guess, to rationalise and get rid of over-regulation. It's almost a micro scale at the end of the, you know, at council. And I know what you're talking about, because it is an annoyance.
And that's just a random example there. I could pull out probably dozens of those examples.
Yeah, the problem is, though, that sometimes those inane things end up in a DA condition, and then your certifier asks you for and then you have to pretend that there's going to be a bin somewhere there isn't, and it's a pain in the ass. It's a complete waste of time.
To put it delicately, yes. you could even lay some of the blame for this at the word processor at Microsoft Word, for being able to copy and paste so many lines of regulations with incredible ease.
Oh, is it going to get worse with AI? I mean, is that going to, like, are we at the cusp of?
Maybe so. But look, I've seen development consents for 40-story buildings issued in 1970. And the planning report is written on one foolscap piece of paper back and front, and the conditions, maybe one or two pages, stuck on with glue. You know, they're bits cut out. And stuck on another piece of paper with glue. And that's how it was done. So we've gone from that, which was arguably inadequate, to a situation where you have development assessment reports that are 40, 50, maybe even 100 pages long or more, and sets of conditions of consent that are like mini novels. So I think the pendulum has swung too far in the other direction. And you could ask yourself, is our built environment any the better for it? And maybe it's not.
Yeah. Look, I think the way I put it, I kind of bring it back to value creation. I think you've hit the nail on the head, over-regulation, and I've raised this. I actually came into a council meeting once and everyone, I said my bit and everyone seemed a bit confused, and then I walked out. But I said, there's something missing in your planning, the broader objectives of the planning department, doesn't talk about value creation. No one thinks about, is this process, is this condition, does this condition, does this DCP, does this on balance, after someone's spent money reading it, spent money thinking about it, a certifier's written an email about it, has it created value for the society that it's serving? And a lot of the times, I would say the answer is no. There's no value created in a condition that asks you to have a landscape maintenance plan for a garden that's 6 meters by 8 meters. Do you know what I mean? So that's my prism. What is the value created by this condition, this new DCP element? What is the value?
Well, I think another issue there is that you have a lot of well-intentioned council staff who are very focused on doing their job as well as they can. And that's how they perceive doing a good job.
Yeah, by applying strictly every bit of everything, even when they're contradictory.
That's right. Well, they don't want to miss something out. You know, if you're a junior planning officer, if you've been out of uni for 2 years and you're at the bottom of the ladder, you don't want to miss something or make a mistake and get in trouble. So you're going to be as thorough as you can.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And absolutely, yeah, we see this.
Brownie points.
We see this all the time, and we see where they've addressed every item of every recommendation, even when those recommendations from their internal council consultants contradict each other, they've still asked us to apply every part of everything.
Well, that's right. This is actually, I think, one of the larger causes of the problem is that, you know, there really aren't enough town planners to go around, or statutory planners, we call them development assessment officers. A lot of them are fairly young. They haven't got the experience or the authority or the seniority or a mixture of all three to make an executive decision on a lot of these things.
Yeah. They're not empowered.
They're not empowered.
They're not trusted.
Maybe that's appropriate. Maybe you don't want them making uninformed or inexperienced executive decisions on everything. But to get those executive decisions that are informed and based on 20 years of experience or more, this is often when people have to appeal to the Land and Environment Court. And then it's a whole different ballgame. Then you've got experts, usually from council, you've got experts engaged who are highly experienced, who do have the confidence to make these executive judgments, and then you're starting to get somewhere.
Yeah. I know we've got to wrap up, but I do want to ask you one more thing, one more topic, and I want to get your opinion. And I think we chatted about this at a Christmas party, but it was NIMBYs versus YIMBYs. And I have this theory that, again, NIMBYs are blamed for a lot more than they actually do, or they're given more credit than they deserve. And I guess I'll give you the context of that. Like, from my perspective, so I live in an area, the inner west, where NIMBYs are supposed to be prolific and supposed to have a real voice. And I think it's very apparent if it's something substantial. But most people in the inner west are quite happy for that. They want to extend their house, and they're quite happy for their neighbors to extend their house. And yes, there is a subset of people who don't like anything and write very long objections. And if sometimes it feels like the core of the objection is, I just don't want anything to happen ever. But I just feel like it's been overblown as a factor.
I think you're absolutely right. In day-to-day practice, although council is required to consider any submissions received in relation to any development application that they're assessing, in reality, they politely consider the submissions. And I won't say that they ignore them all, but they will deal with the ones that are relevant and pay attention to the ones that are relevant. But a lot of, quite possibly 80% of the submissions received don't carry a lot of weight. You know, say, for example, one of the submissions is complaining that the development is going to overshadow their entire backyard. when they're actually located to the, on the northern side of the development. So that's just not physically possible. So things like that.
Oh, yeah, they get even more absurd. I mean, we've had a lot of objections where it just says, I don't want trucks in my street. And there's zero planning law reference.
So for a council planning officer, reading the submissions is sometimes very entertaining because you get some bizarre ones that just make no sense or don't have any relevance to the planning legislation as it's applied. Sometimes relevant issues are raised and the assessing officer makes an effort to resolve an issue between neighbours.
Yeah.
And that happens in dense inner city areas, and that's helpful. So it might result in a condition or a couple of conditions on a consent to help resolve this situation to keep all parties happy. So you have a win solution, and that's fair and reasonable if that happens, and that's good for comfortable community relations.
So essentially, we're letting NIMBYs off the hook, we're letting planners off the hook, we're letting everyone, and it is council and legislation. Is it?
Well, another issue is that councils are understaffed.
Yeah, they
and
are.
They have been since the early 2000s. So, and that's continuous. I don't know if that will continue to be the case. Maybe we need a good recession to alter that. But at the moment, council planners leave council for better salaries in state government or private practice. So what do you do?
Yeah. What do you do?
I don't think the people are there. I don't think the staff are there anyway, coming out of university. And there are plenty of them, but maybe we need more. Maybe we need more of a budget to hire them in local government, but that's not necessarily going to solve the problem.
Maybe we need to have a program where the government subsidizes ex-planners to bring them out of retirement to.
Well, I think that probably has happened informally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's probably plenty of work for planners who might otherwise want to retire.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I do think that, yes, absolutely right. Okay, so when you think about that situation, when you think about a situation where you're understaffed, say you're in an emergency department in a hospital and you're understaffed, there's a triage situation. You will be treated. You may not get the same level of care if they're stretched, but you will be treated. If you're bleeding, you'll be hopefully sorted. I guess you might have to wait if you've got a small cut to be stitched up. But do you think that the planning industry can learn from other systems where there's constraints or there's limited staff? Is there a better system of allocation and maybe killing some patients along the way, but saving more of the patients means that you let some go? Like when push comes to shove and it's a real triage and you've, like back in COVID, there was only so many beds and you have to focus on who are you most likely to save.
Well, I suppose when people lodge a DA, it's first come, first served usually.
Yeah.
I got mine in before you, so mine gets dealt with first.
Except that which planner you get allocated to has hugely more of an impact to which order your DA came.
Well, it does very often. Look, it is complicated. It's not just the planner. They have to refer their DA for specialist comments to the engineering department, to the tree department, to the social services department, to et cetera, et cetera. All these other council departments, and maybe they need to refer them to external government agencies. Now, sometimes the external government agencies, the state government agencies, which might hold things up. And it's got nothing to do with council.
Okay. We seem to always revert to what's wrong with council, but what can we do better? Like, what can I do better? What can you do better? What can planners consulting for council and private, what can collectively we do better?
Well, there are a lot of questions there, but in terms of planners consulting with to proponents, so the private sector, they best do their job and satisfy their role when they're helping their client prepare the most thorough development application that they can. So one that ticks all the boxes, and where it doesn't tick the boxes, it does its best to minimise the issues. and provides all the necessary information so that there are going to be minimal issues when it starts going through the system. But most of the things that get refused or rejected, they're not being refused because the applicant is making a greedy floor space grab. It's not because they're proposing something that's twice the height limit or significantly over the FSR allowance for the site. And it's often because, in fact, often these things are fully compliant with the numbers. But it's on a merit assessment of how they relate to their context, and this goes to the level of detail in the controls, that there are other issues and other reasons for why they don't tick all the boxes. And often these are very subjective. Often they relate to heritage. Is this colour brick appropriate or is that colour brick appropriate? Is it appropriate to demolish or fill in that window or not fill it in? And there's going to be a big argument about a little thing like this, or at least a conversation, and a lot of a time-consuming conversation about some of these very detailed points. And that takes time.
Yeah.
But in preparing a development application, at least you can be prepared for these sort of issues.
And is it true that the nicer your application, the nicer the artwork, the better chance you got? This is something that James Phillips, someone you know well, someone you worked with for a long time, he was a proponent of make it look pretty and make it look nice. That's my memory. I'm misquoting and misrepresenting slight, but in effect.
I've heard him say that, and I have a lot of respect for James Phillips, and he's absolutely right, particularly where heritage comes into play. Not so much if you're talking about the town planners, they want information that is clear, concise, and communicates what you're doing accurately. It's legible and understandable. And I've seen applications which are not legible, and the planners are struggling to understand, and they might make the wrong decision based on a misunderstanding. But in terms of heritage, in terms of larger developments where you have a design review panel of a panel of architects reviewing an application, if you've got nice looking drawings, that's really important. Things need to be documented well, drawn well, and as James says, they've got to look beautiful. And that helps sell a scheme. But it's sort of like your 3D photo renderings.
Absolutely. Yeah. They sell apartments.
They do. And it's not going to help you tick the boxes about FSR and site coverage and whether you comply with the height limit or not, but it's going to be compelling and convincing where there's a discussion about whether it sits comfortably in a significant landscape or a significant urban streetscape or something like that.
Yeah, I think the quality of the information conveyed, I would argue that's the single biggest factor that where people can really change the nature of their submission. Make it beautiful, make it clear, make it simple, make it easy to understand. When the planner feels like they're smart and they get it and they feel good about it, they're going to be more positive in a sense. It is subjective, right? It is subjective.
Some of it is, yes, indeed. And look, I have seen over time a lot of very badly prepared applications, drawings and documentations which aren't clear, that don't explain the application well and don't make it look very appealing. So I've seen some really sloppy documentation.
They get low grades.
Help.
Like an assignment, they get lower grade. They get graded down, and that could be the difference between a pass and a fail, right?
They certainly don't grease the wheels.
All right, Philip North, that might be a great place to leave it. I really appreciate your time. I know you've got things to do. You're a very busy man. Philip North from PCN Urban, and of course, we'll create a link to your company, and then people can find you in links to this podcast. Thanks so much, Philip, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.